maybe you want to reflect on, is the bookkeeping and accounting helping you make decisions?
Even with us chatting with Joanna and planning for this podcast, Stephen and I
just learned something
new. And so, you know, even if you've been in business for 15 years and you're like, oh, I know this already, I would urge you to hang out, to stick around and just listen. Things change.
It's always a pleasure to catch up and talk with you guys. You have such great insight into the industry.
Welcome to ABA Business Leaders, brought to you by 3 Pi Squared, where we discuss topics on how to create and grow an ethical and sustainable ABA practice.
Whether you're starting, scaling, or thinking about selling your business, we're here to share insights, stories, and strategies to help you on the journey.
We owned a successful ABA practice for over 10 years.
And now we help other ABA business owners do the same without all the chaos.
Stick around. You're in the right place.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to ABA Business Leaders Podcast, brought to you by 3 Pi Squared. I'm April.
I'm Stephen.
Today, we have a special guest with us. I will introduce Joanna here in a few minutes. But first, I'll just intro our Back to Basics season. Yeah. So we're continuing our Back to Basics series, where we go back to the foundations of running an ABA business. Whether you're dreaming about starting a company, already running one, or preparing for what's next, we will meet you where you are. And just like early intervention, the earlier you start working on these foundations, the better your chances of success. The fewer problems you'll face and the smoother your growth will be. All right. Well, that is out of the way.
All right.
So now I get to introduce Joanna. Those of you guys who have been around for a while have already met her and may already even be working with them. So Joanna is a certified public accountant who owns Margin Keepers, an accounting practice that specializes in the ABA industry. Her firm has serviced hundreds of ABA practices over the last decade. She has a master's degree from the University of Notre Dame in accounting, where she concentrated on financial reporting and assurance. Joanna's early career in healthcare gave her a deep understanding of the industry. And at Margin Keepers, they provide bookkeeping, financial reporting, income tax compliance work. And their focus is setting up the numbers so the ABA owners can make final financial decisions that support long-term financial health. So welcome, Joanna. We are so glad to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. No, it's a pleasure to be back. It's always a pleasure to catch up and talk with you guys. You have such great insight into the industry.
Well, thank you so much for that. Well, we're excited to hear about what information you're bringing for us today. We're going to cover several things. We're going to talk about what ABA business leaders need to do to prepare for taxes. This is airing in December. This is the, you know, end of the year. I don't know how in the world we landed, right?
Yeah.
At the end of the year already. This is going to be a little different than a lot of our Back to Basics episodes, because everything that we're talking about is really going to be geared towards
everybody.
All of you guys, yep. Right? And now where we can look at, like, looking at how can we do this differently? How can we, you know, it's those beginners, those startups, in the first year or two, going ahead and taking all of this advice that we talk about today and figuring out how you're going to put that in your processes and how you're going to start off doing things the right way. And those of you guys who are the growers, who are in the middle phases of your business, who, you know, it's a really great opportunity for you to look in and take note and check in and say, okay, do I have processes and procedures for these? If I don't, what can we do to audit our systems and to get things into play, get mm-hmm. things in place, right? So I just wanted to bring that up, that really we're not going to necessarily break all of these pieces down, because it's going to be super applicable to everyone. And I can guarantee you're going to come out of this with some new information, because even with us chatting with Joanna and planning for this podcast, Stephen and I,
Just learn something.
Just learn something new. And so, you know, even if you've been in business for 15 years and you're like, oh, I know this already, I would urge you to hang out, to stick around and just listen. Things change. We forget about things, yep. Things drop off. And so these are all important. So we're going to talk about preparing for taxes. And, ideally we're talking about it here at the end of the year because all of us business owners are thinking about it. However, let's not wait till December to prepare for the year.
I mean, ideally, but there's it happens every year, right? Yeah. You just have this mass panic. Oh my goodness.
Or at least do yourself a favor and plan for it. Yeah. Say, okay, I know that I'm going to be doing some rushed things at the end of the year. There are some things that I need to take care of, things that I need to know. So go ahead a few months ahead, like in October, September, October, go ahead and look at your calendar and mark yourself off or mark yourself busy for those few, like for some space, right? Yeah. So that you can really take the time to work on this. But then we're also going to talk about cash flow management. And then also we're going to chat a little bit about, Joanna has some information for us about how some providers are taking payment up front to kind of help support that cash flow management. So we'll get to that towards the end. I can't wait to talk more about it. But let's just jump into that, the preparing for taxes. And I know like one of your first points here is accurate bookkeeping. And there again, that's what we would start from January 1, ideally.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Ideally, like you would have been doing this throughout the year. But if you haven't, we're still on time, you know, to deal with it before you actually go into the time to have to do your taxes, right? And the reason that accurate bookkeeping is so important is because you're going to hand over those reports to a tax preparer, right? And they're going to rely on those to fill out their tax forms, right? They're not going to question or they have no requirement to audit and really dig into anything, right? So, if you hand them over and there's mistakes, you could possibly lose deductions, right? Which nobody wants to do because we all want to pay less taxes. Or you could possibly understate revenue, which we also don't want to do because then if we get audited, we'd get in trouble, right? About the money we didn't report. And then they tack on interest and penalties for not paying that back in the year it was due. So it is really important, right? If you're doing your bookkeeping yourself, you know, that's fine, but I highly recommend that you ask the tax preparer, hey, do you do bookkeeping too? Can you do a review of my bookkeeping just to make sure it's okay before you go into tax? Because then that way they might find some of the issues. QuickBooks seems really easy, right? It's very user-friendly. And as far as like coding expenses and revenue, that is quite straightforward, right? But one of the financial statements that's necessary for income tax compliance is called a balance sheet. And this statement's more complicated. And a lot of the accounting regarding that can easily be done incorrectly if you don't have an accounting background, right? So, for example, accounting for loan payments. You might have a loan and then you think whenever it gets paid, you're going to code it to that loan, right? But loan payments generally have an interest portion and a principal portion. And if you don't split those, then first, your loan balance isn't right, right? So you might be thinking you owe less than you do. And second, you won't be getting a deduction for that interest expense, which is a valuable deduction. So that's an example of a balance sheet activity that might be harder to account for if you don't have an accounting background. The second most common issues I find when the financials are wrong when they were doing the accounting themselves is payroll. Very easy to make a lot of mistakes. It's not straightforward, right? Mm-hmm. People get paid. There's a portion of that payment that goes to the IRS, and part of it is not that you're paying it, but the employee's paying it. And so a lot of times I find people incorrectly code the whole amount they remit to the IRS's expense, but in reality, a portion of that is not your company's expense. That's your employee's portion that they're giving. And you've already expensed their payroll. So when you then go and code that whole tax payment to tax expense, you're overstating your expenses. And so that's a common area. So there are lots of common areas that can have issues. So it's always worth having a check. And if you haven't done any bookkeeping, it's really going to delay your process for actually filing taxes. And And a lot of people don't care about this until they decide they need a loan during the year. Like, oh, I want to open a clinic now and I need a loan. And the bank's going to come and say, where's your tax return? And they're going to go, oh, well, hold on. Let me go check with the tax accountant. And the tax accountant might inform them there's no bookkeeping done. We have to do a whole year's worth of accounting before we can even do your taxes. So it's going to take a while. So it's important, like, beforehand to get everything ready. Also, you can save money by proactively doing it, because if you do during the tax season, because there's a lack of capacity, prices go up at accounting firms, right? We're constrained on capacity. We can only do so much work. And because of that, it increases prices. So you might end up paying more at that time than had you proactively done it during the year.
Those are really good points. And those are things that I think can easily get away from us as the year flies by, right?
Yeah. Like now we're in December, all of a sudden, exactly. Like what happened?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So, you know, even having those, if you don't already have that bookkeeping in place, I think that would be a great goal for, of course, you're going to have to go back and do for this year, but how are you going to put that into play for the following year to go ahead and start that bookkeeping January 1 and doing it in the correct ways?
Yep.
Because it's kind of that you don't know what you don't know. And so having someone who knows all of the ins and outs, at least guiding you would be important, because some of those mistakes that we make as we learn and kind of just do it on our own as we go, those mistakes can get a little costly.
Well, I mean, especially for growers, and I mean, I'm kind of, but you know, I know we had this issue, mm-hmm. but when you're hiring people quickly and you're growing quickly and you're used to paying payroll taxes quarterly, and then it's like, oh man, now I'm in this area where I have to pay it biweekly or monthly now. And if you're not doing this in advance, you may not recognize that. So yeah, anything like that can help with projections and understanding what your obligations are would be beneficial.
Yeah. And for our growers, if they already do have, they're listening, they already have bookkeeping in place, maybe you want to reflect on, is the bookkeeping and accounting helping you make decisions? Because like Stephen just went over, you might be needing to make decisions about how much money you need, you know, growing, adding more people, et cetera. And if the financial statements don't really help you understand that, then it might be worth reflecting on, are there any changes that we could do in our accounting to help us make better decisions in this growth phase?
You know, it kind of, to me, as I'm sitting here listening and like kind of with a clinical, more like a clinical perspective here, because that's, that's where I was at. That's who I was in our ABA company. It would almost be like, I think it would be fair to say that it would be like providing services for a learner, but not collecting data on the daily, right? And like not keeping up with that daily data. It's in helping data guide your decisions.
Yeah.
And then making random or making guesses or making like decisions that you feel like are right. But then you look back and you're like, okay, now let me put the data in now. And now let me look at the graph. And then you realize where you thought you were is different than where you really were. And then you have to adjust.
You're open to more risk and making assumptions that you absolutely shouldn't make.
Yeah. Like you're going to make a decision on intervention without actually looking at the data.
Right.
Yeah.
You're just going to decide ballpark, you know, I think it's working.
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't do that in your field. Right. So it's the same for this as in regards to the financial health of your company.
But these are things that are easy to overlook or to not, like, I can get to that later.
Yeah, it's totally head in the sand. We did that. Oh, always. Yeah, always.
Yeah.
I assume, like, this is probably a busy time of year for you. Like, how busy is that before, on the 26th until January 1st? Is that, like, a busy time of year for you?
No, because no one's proactive. Okay. Everyone's going to call in January and February with an issue. That's when it really, like, I guess people are like, oh, you know, it's what time and I haven't got my stuff together.
Okay.
And in regards, like, for the bookkeeping for our closers that might be listening, right? They're very important. You want to look at it because the valuation of your company is going to be based off those financial statements. So if your bookkeeping is not up to par, if it's not done right, you could be losing value, right? They're going to use those numbers to determine how much you're worth. And you want to make sure they're as accurate as possible to get your maximum valuation. So if you are thinking about going to the closing stage next year, you want to make sure your accounting is down packed.
Yeah, that's really good advice.
And like for the closers, okay, they sell their business in February. What kind of implication are they looking at for the next year? Do you like that? I mean, obviously it depends on the price. Right, what they get. But I assume that's going to be a huge tax bill at the end of the year.
Yeah, well, it depends on a lot of factors, right? The structure of the deal, whether it was factors in asset sale or an equity sale. So most of the time, ABA practices, they're going to structure them as asset sales, right? So it is going to be a significant tax bill because of the allocation of that purchase price. And that's a very good thing to think about when we're looking at the bookkeeping, because if, let's say, you're doing cash basis bookkeeping, which is very common for most companies, right? Small businesses, more affordable, you don't really have an accounts receivable balance. And like when you're selling, they allocate the price amongst assets, right? So you're going to want to make sure that you know your accounts receivable and how much it is, because there are different tax rates for the amounts allocated to accounts receivable versus goodwill, right? Where goodwill is basically whatever's left. So they'll look at a company and they'll say, these are the tangible assets. So let's say they have equipment worth $100,000 and they have AR for $300,000 and the sales for $1 million, right? The $600,000 remaining is going to be allocated to goodwill. Each of those buckets has different tax implications. So it's important to make sure you have good financials, even from that point of view, from the tax perspective, after the valuation and the deal's getting done.
Okay, so walk us through the steps of understanding the implications of the owner's tax structure.
Okay, yeah. So for people just starting out, I find they're really confused about it. They don't really understand. So almost all entities, everybody listening that has a company, more likely than not, has an S-corp, an LLC, a partnership, a sole proprietorship, right? The grand majority of entities in the United States are these types, and they are called flow-through entities, which means that they themselves do not pay taxes, but the money flows through to your personal return, and then you individually pay that tax, right? And that's something I find the clients really don't understand at the beginning. And because of that, they're not understanding, well, why do I owe this money? Why doesn't the company owe this money, et cetera, right? It doesn't mean that the company doesn't get its own return, because in several of those scenarios, the company will have its own tax return. It just won't pay taxes on that return. Right. So a lot of people just starting out are understanding like the company had 50,000 profit. Why can't you just tell me what the tax amount is? Well, because it flows through to your personal return. And if you're married to Alex and he's got a W-2 job and he makes $100,000, right? And you have three kids and you own a house, everything is going to come into play, right? So all of that money gets combined, your personal situation, all the deductions that exist for you at a personal level come into play to see what that money actually gets taxed at. So that's what's really important when you're just starting out, understanding, right? More likely than not, your company, while it may report for income tax purposes, that money's going to flow through to you and you are personally going to pay the taxes on that. So you need to think about all the other things that impact that tax, especially if you're like trying to save for tax, right? And you might think, oh, I'm going to save 20%. That's the average amount that Americans are paying, right? Mm-hmm. But if you have a high income earner spouse, you might be paying your first dollar at 35 to 40%, right? So you need to think about that. So that's what I mean by understanding the implications of your tax structure. So understand what type of entity do I have? And it can even be a different tax entity than a legal entity, right? So a lot of people, you hear them say, I have an LLC, S-Corp. What does that mean? It means that from a legal perspective, you have an LLC. But from an income tax perspective, you have an S-Corp. So it gets taxed differently. So it's really important at the beginning to understand that as you're growing and closing, it's important to understand whether you're still in the right vehicle, right? Mm-hmm. Assessing that. Maybe you started off as an LLC single member and you've been working like that, but maybe it's time to think about making that S-Corp election because that might be more preferential.
Because you can bring over some dividends, I guess is what it's called, right? Where it's taxed at less because it's not income earned. It's like capital gains, is that, am I saying that correctly?
Well, yeah, so dividends are taxed at capital gains. That's correct. As far as like the money coming through, most only C-Corps actually give like proper dividends and most of these entities, like I don't have many clients that decide to operate in C-Corp because of the double taxation of those entities. They get taxed like at the net income level. So those entities do get, they're not flow through, right? They do get taxed on their tax return. And then all the dividends that flow through then get taxed at the personal. And so dividends do get taxed at a preferential rate if they meet certain requirements. But people might think, oh, well, I'm going to do that because I get hit less with the dividends. But it doesn't usually turn out to be less because you do pay the tax at that corporate level. And that's when you hear people say double tax, two layers of tax, double taxation. That's what happens. The C-Corp reports its income, pays taxes on it, distributes the money, and then the shareholders then pay tax again on those dividends. So
every time we talk, Joanne, like my brain's like, because I'm learning so much. And I really feel like a lot of the clinical side, right? Those clinicians who are opening their company or running their company, if they haven't already learned about this, and like those beginners who like me, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of you guys out here who already have like a strong knowledge of this going into it, and great for you. Mm-hmm. But I also know that there is a large portion of us clinicians who go into business without understanding or knowing any of this, and we're learning as we go. And so I just want to take a second, like, yes. So Margin Keepers, are sponsors of, you know, to be completely transparent. Mm-hmm. If you guys have been around, you already know this, that Margin Keepers are sponsors for our podcast. And the reason that they're sponsors for our podcast is because we have like a very stringent vetting, you know, procedure. Like we don't just have anyone as an affiliate or a sponsor, right? But we want to make sure that it's valuable to all of you listeners out there. And like, if you are in this situation and you're like already just a few minutes into this podcast, you're like, wow, there's a lot that I don't know. And I'm getting kind of nervous and worried about how all of this is working out and if I'm doing it right, please just reach out to Margin Keepers.
Yeah, many of our customers are Margin Keeper customers. Yeah. And all I hear is amazing from Joanna and Sam.
So yeah, so if you're feeling stressed right now, just take a deep breath and
sign up for the free consult on our website. Yeah. It'll be in the show notes too.
And just reach out to Sam and Joanna and like they'll help walk you through some of these pieces and help you to know like where, if you're on the right track or not. So anyways, I just feel like this could be like really stressful for people who are still learning or who have been in business for years, and maybe they're realizing, oh, maybe I need to do something differently moving forward. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah.
And we're always happy on the free consults to give as much information as we can, right? We value just getting to know more people in the industry and talking to you guys, hearing your struggles and challenges. You don't necessarily, you know, need to pay us to get some valuable information.
That's awesome. Okay. Well, to get back on track here, talking about like tax structure, I know that you said that there's owner's health insurance premiums. There's like specific things you need to do for that.
Yeah. So another thing about on the topic of, you know, understanding the implications of your tax structure is how you deal with health insurance, because that varies depending on your structure. And you want to make sure you get a deduction for your own health insurance, especially a lot of you leave your jobs, you know, to start your practices and you need health insurance, right? And at your job, you might have been getting it through payroll, right? So it's important to understand, how can I get a deduction for my health insurance now that I'm self-employed? Okay. And so if your entity is taxed as an S-Corp or is an S-Corp, there are requirements to run it through your payroll. And this is something that I see often. I have to tell the clients to do it. Like, it's not something that's common knowledge. So if your entity is taxed as an S-Corp, you need to run those premiums through payroll. Now, it doesn't mean that you need to pay for them. You can set them up on your payroll as 100% covered by your company. And it doesn't matter if your coverage is different for your employees, because this is just for the owner of the S-Corp, right? So you could put in 100% coverage, companies covering it, right? But it needs to run through there. The other important thing is that your payroll company needs to know that you are taxed as an S-Corp, and they need to know that you're a more than 2% shareholder of that S-Corp, because those two things will impact the way they flow that through on your W-2. And unless it flows through exactly how it needs to on that W-2, the tax preparer is not going to be able to get a deduction for it. And so we all know health insurance is very expensive and only keeps rising. So this is a good deduction, right? So you can also include, as the S-Corp owner, your family's coverage, right? So as long as your spouse doesn't work at a W-2 job who's offered coverage for himself and his family, then you can include your family as well in that policy. And so if you don't have an S-Corp, just have an LLC, maybe taxed as a partnership or single member or your sole proprietor, then you just make sure you let your tax accountant know about the health insurance, because there is a way for them to get that deduction on your individual return. So that's where the understanding the tax entity structure comes into play, right? You just need to know, okay, how do I get this health insurance deduction based on my entity structure? Because there's special rules surrounding it. For S-Corp owners, the health insurance does help, because I don't know if some of the listeners know, but if you have an S-Corp, there's something called reasonable salary requirements, right? So the IRS says if you are the more than 2% shareholder of an S-Corp, right, and you work at this company in any capacity, you need a reasonable salary for your role there, right? Meaning it's a market salary. You're going to pay Sandra from across the street this money, and she's going to be happy to do it. And she has same qualifications as you, about same experience, right? So she would be a competitor for a job with you, right? So that reasonable salary, the lower it is, the more tax savings, right? So that's where the incentive comes to put low salaries, which is why the IRS throws out all these regulations about making it reasonable, because they don't want people taking advantage of the system, right? So, but that health insurance premium does help, because let's say a reasonable salary is $60,000 for the position we're looking at, right? And but the health insurance for the year that you're going to get for yourself and your family is $10,000. Well, now you could set the salary to $50,000, because that $10,000 is going to get added into the number to come to $60,000. So that's where you could get some benefit, right? Because now, okay, I am lowering my reasonable salary, but I'm still meeting the guideline. Mm-hmm. So there is some tax strategy involved also in those health insurance premiums and how they come into play for the S-Corp owners.
Yeah, I'm just not a fan of taxes.
Yeah.
It's a cat and mouse
Steven, who's a fan of taxes?
Yeah.
It's just, we have to do it. It's So as far as looking at quarterlies and year-end planning, what kind of strategy or advice do you have?
Yeah. So first, I guess let's talk about what quarterlies are, because there's a lot of confusion around it, right?
Okay.
So essentially, if you're self-employed in any manner, whether you have a business or you're just a contractor that goes around working for people, right, you are required to remit estimated quarterly tax payments on the money you've earned, right? Because if we think about it, if I'm just a contractor and I go work and you guys are paying me, I don't have like a pay stub with a W-2, right, where you're withholding the money. You're doing me a favor. You're withholding the money for me and sending it, right, to the state and the IRS. So this is how they get their money essentially during the year, because taxes due when you earn money, not at the end of the year, right? Which a lot of people don't understand. They're like, oh, wait, when I file my taxes, that's when it's due. No, theoretically, it is due as you earn the money, right? Which is why people get withheld their money on their pay stubs, right? And so when you're self-employed, it's your responsibility to remit these quarterly estimated payments. And so that's the first level of confusion. Like, people didn't know. Oh, I didn't know. Like, they were in business a year and they didn't know, or even sometimes multiple years and they didn't know. They were just paying it at the end of the year with penalties and interest, not really knowing, hey, there's a way to avoid these penalties and interest if I'm proactively paying in my taxes every quarter. So that's the first thing I'd like the listeners to be aware of if they weren't already. The second thing about this, that there's a lot of misconceptions, like I'll get clients and they'll tell me, oh, no, but I'm an S-Corp and I'm an employee and I withheld taxes on my W-2. And that is fine for the income you earn through the W-2, but the other income, which is the profit that's left, so you get paid, you pay everyone, there's profit left in the company, that money has not been taxed. So that's a comment. They're like, I don't understand. I was paying my W-2. Yeah, but that's only for your salary. And there's another 100 grand here of profit that's not been taxed. So the quarterlies would be on that additional money, right? Which you would have to factor your W-2, because as we talked about earlier, it's not an easy calculation. Like, we wish it was. When people ask me and I have to explain, it's so confusing. And it's like, I wish it was 20% and I just multiply it, you know? Right. But it's not. So like when you do in the S corp, you do have to factor, I had my W-2 income and the profit from the company to get that estimate. Another common thing people will tell me is like, oh no, I don't have to pay because I paid with Gusto or ADP or paychecks, right? And they don't mean like their W-2, but they, you know how when you own the company, you file those quarterly reports for the payroll with all the tax money that you withheld, the Social Security and Medicare you were paying, right? All that money, right? And they're like, I paid that. And then, so they're not understanding that is money related to your payroll. That's payroll tax. When we file your taxes, that's an income tax, a tax on income, not payroll. They're not associated, right? So no, you haven't paid it. And it's really hard. Like sometimes they're like insisting, I'm like, there's no way that ADP knows how much money your company made. Were you telling them? You know, I always ask them, like, were you disclosing to them how much money you're making, sending them quarterly financials? And they still kind of drill on, but it's important to understand those are payroll taxes. And when we file our taxes at the end of the year, that's income tax. So they're separate taxes. So when you pay these taxes, right, the quarterlies, right, either you can sit down and actually project and say, okay, I'm factoring to owe this amount. Now, because of the implications with how to calculate the tax, it's so complicated. Most people couldn't do that, right? They might have a service like we do that as a company. That's a service that clients can sign up for. We actually will sit down and pretend like we're doing their taxes on March 31st, right? To see how much they owe for that first quarter payment, right? But if you're not doing that, you know, you don't want to pay an accountant to do that. You don't want to have to sit down and figure that. There is a safe harbor rule the IRS has that will allow you to not pay penalties and interest. And that's if you pay 100% of the tax that you owed from last year. So if it's 2025 and I go and I say, hey, last year, 2024, my total taxes were, and we should remember that it's not just like what my accountant told me I had to pay when I filed. It's the actual total tax number on that return, right? So on your 1040, that's the tax form for people. It's line 24. That'll say total tax. So let's say that said $20,000 last year. Well, I could go and I could pay $5,000 each of my quarterlies in 2025. And that will make sure that I don't pay penalties and interest because I paid 100% of the tax I owed last year.
Okay. So if you're like, okay, I don't have my stuff together and I don't know how much to pay, I can just go back and look at last year and pay that same amount.
Yes.
To kind of, while I'm figuring it out. Now, what if it comes out to be less than that? Do you get your money back or no?
Yes, of course. So you'll get a refund when you file. And if it's too little, you'll make a payment when you file. Right, so they'll never keep anything that wasn't actually due.
You just won't have to pay the penalties
and interest. Yeah.
That's a cool trick.
And so if you're a grower, right, you might not want to use that method if you don't want to end up with a huge tax bill, right? Because if you're actively growing, you're probably going to owe more money this year than last year. And if you don't like to be in a position where somebody's telling you you owe a large amount of money at the end of the year, then you want to be proactive and you want to actually get estimates done by an accountant or a tax preparer.
Yeah.
During the year.
Growing is super exciting. And I know we get excited. We're like, oh, we're growing. We're, you know, we've hired X many people this year. We've gone from, I know it's not always neat and tidy from January to December, but let's just say, right? Like from January to December, you've like tripled your business. I think too that also makes for really complicated like planning, forecasting. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're like, which is common, right? A lot of my clients may be getting a mortgage during the year, right? Most of the time you won't get a mortgage if you owe any taxes. So if you put yourself in a situation where you're not really proactively planning and paying, you come to year end, you owe $40,000. You don't have it. You go on a payment plan, and then during the year you want to buy a house, they'll probably require you to pay that off completely. I have seen very few banks waive that requirement in the past. Mm-hmm. Like, they want the IRS paid in full because the IRS is ultimate power of collection, right? Yeah. And the bank doesn't want the IRS to take the house right. to satisfy their debt, right? Because they will come over the banks, right? Mm-hmm. So that's important. And if you're a closer, right, and you're looking to sell, you want to make sure you don't have any tax obligations, because they mm-hmm. will check for that during due diligence and closing procedures when you are making that sale. And so you want to make sure you don't have that over your head to deal with.
Yeah, that would stink. Yeah. Okay, so is there anything else regarding Coralie's and urine planning that we...
No, I think that was it. Yeah,
okay. We covered. Okay, so let's move on to, I think, a topic that's going to really... resonate with everybody at in December, early December. Should you make purchases before the year ends? A lot of times as business owners are like, oh, you know, maybe I'm worried that we didn't like spend enough money to like, you know, make a loss or like whatever to like, you know, offset the taxes. I don't know the right words.
Yeah.
So let's like buy a bunch of stuff, or let's go ahead and like stock up on things, you know, at the end of the year, so that we can offset some of that.
Yeah. So the first and most important rule is that you're only going to buy things if it makes sense, right? Buying something just to get a tax write-off is never good advice. Right? Because you're still losing out more money. So if you're still spending $100 to get the $30 write-off, right? So it's kind of, you're actually having a larger cash outflow than actually paying the tax. So unless it's something that's part of the plan that would be beneficial, I would not go on a spending spree, right? Especially as we'll talk later about the cash flow effects. We all know at the beginning of the year is pretty rough in this industry, right? So you want to make sure you're not depleting all your cash just to get a deduction, right? Now, putting that aside, if there is something you were thinking about getting, like perhaps you're going to open a clinic space next year and you anticipate needing a lot of furniture and supplies, et cetera, right? If you're going to buy it anyway and you want the write-off this year, then yeah, that's great, right? Just make sure you have a good cash position. You're not going to deplete your funds and get yourself in a bad position, right? And keep in mind that you might still owe tax. So a lot of times people think, oh, I've got this deduction, you know, it's that I owe $1,000 in tax. So then they say, oh, well, here I also had this $1,000 computer I bought. Well, it doesn't lower the taxes $1,000.
Right.
It's just a deduction, right? So it lowers the expense somewhat, but not dollar for dollar. Right. So that's important to understand, that you might still owe tax and you need the cash to pay that. If it make, like I said, if it makes sense and you want to do it right, then you can go ahead and purchase things, right? Cars are a popular item. Like if you were planning on, you know, updating your car next year, right? That gets you large deductions the first year, right? But it's not the whole amount either, right? So you just need to consider like the deductibility. Some things are not 100% deductible at all, and some things are not 100% deductible in that first year. So a car is a good example. You're not getting the write-off for $70,000, right? It's usually the first year around $18,000 to $20,000, depending on what tax laws in play, right? So you're not going to get that whole. So don't think, oh, I'm going to buy the car, finance it, it's $80,000, I'm going to have to write the whole thing off, right? You want to check with your accountant. Hey, if I buy this car, what's the tax write-off available? So you have a better understanding of how much you're actually going to get. Mm-hmm. As that cut off, right? Other than that, like if you are looking to decrease money at the end of the year, right? I always, you know, advise, you know, like look out for your staff, right? So if you did make extra profit, you are paying a lot, you know, and you weren't planning on throwing them a bonus, throw them a bonus, you know, because that's going to deduct the money from you. It's going to transfer to them and it's going to keep morale up. And anything else that you think, you know, if you think having a good Christmas party is going to be great for morale, right, then do it, you know. You want to do team building. So always things that will add value to your practice, right, which the staff should always be first, because they are everything at your practice, right?
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad that you bring that up, because that's another thing we'd like to talk about is how does that work? Like when you have Christmas holiday gifts and bonuses and parties, gift cards, or, you know, how does all of that work with payroll and taxes and all of it? What's important to know?
I want
to
give everybody a $250 Amazon gift card. How do I
do that? So if you are going to give gift cards to the staff, it's important to note that you still need to report it as compensation through the payroll system. And so this is a mistake a lot of people make. They don't know they need to do that. But it is the law that if you give them gift cards, you need to run it through the payroll if you're going to take that deduction for it, right? So you would need to, if you gave everyone $250 Amazon gift cards, when you run payroll the next time, you would need to add that on as something you gave them. And you'll, if you're not sure how to run that through, you want to talk with the support of the payroll company, because it can be tricky. You don't want to pay them the $250 again on that paycheck. You just want to tell it, I already paid them $250, add it here and put the tax on it and make sure it goes through that W-2. So this is the same for if you Venmo them money, Cash App them, if you give them cash at the party, you know, you need to report it through the payroll. It needs to go on their W-2. And the only way that's going to happen is if it goes on the payroll. So if you do that and you come back for the new year and you hadn't done that, or you're listening to this in the new year, right, you're going to want to just like check if the W-2s haven't been issued, then you can go and you can let the payroll company know. It's usually called an after the fact payroll. And you just let, you want to report an after the fact payroll. Please walk me through how to do it. And then you get that reported in there, right? Even if the W-2s have been issued, you could still do it, but then it's going to issue a corrected W-2. And you don't want to, like, the staff might have already filed their taxes. Now you're telling me I need it, you know, so just try to be proactive about it so it doesn't end up being a trouble for your staff, you know? Okay.
Would it be easier just to add the bonus to the paycheck?
Yeah, that's the best, right? So even though people like to, you know, give the cash, mm-hmm. give the gift card to their face, it is best just to run it through payroll, right? You can always send them a nice email or tell them in person, hey, I want you to know on your next check, there's going to be an extra $200 there, and that's to help for Christmas.
Give them a card with like a message, a like handwritten message. Who gets those anymore, right? That would be kind of a special edition. And saying, hey, by the way, you have your bonus, and then like tell them something nicer.
Yeah.
What about gifts? Like, is that, what if you said, okay, I'm not going to get a gift card. I'm going to go to Bucky's. I'm going to buy them $250 worth of stuff. Like how would that, are you in the same boat?
So gifts, you're allowed to give up to $25 per employee, right? If it's more than that, then you'd need to report it as giving it to them. Some ways that we could possibly get around this is give them a gift that might work for both of you. So how about a branded tablet carrier? You know, it's marketing, right? We've got our logo on it. They're taking it around to clients. Everyone's seeing it, right? And we could possibly write that off as advertising instead of gift, which doesn't have a limit, right? Brand them up on t-shirts. It could be uniform, right? They could decide to wear it to the thing, right? To see clients, right? So if you can find a way that it works for both of you, then there might be a way to get a better deduction for it.
So if you're worried about like every penny that you spend and you want to get the best tax deduction, give your staff merch, like company merch.
Yeah.
But if you really care for your staff and you want to give them something that they can use for themselves, then give them a bonus, report it to payroll, and write them a nice handwritten card or email.
I'm going to throw you a curveball. What if I give them a tip?
Well, tips are reportable on the payroll as well, like, so,
but
you,
it's tax free now, right?
Well, the new legislation being passed, but I don't think it's effective till next year. So
okay,
I didn't know about that. Yeah. It's like a new thing. It's not started yet. Okay, well, maybe next year we can
I'm just trying to figure out. Yeah, I'm just trying to cheat the system, I guess.
Well, and then it's also important too, like if you're going to prepay expenses, there are some that can't be deducted. So like the rule is, if you're prepaying something, you're a cash basis taxpayer, like the benefit needs to be within a year. So just make sure you're if you are going to prepay stuff, run it through your accountant so they could check the current legislation, like what is allowed to going to be deducted this year, you know? There are situations because really you're just delaying, right?
Right.
We're not taking something away. We're just pushing it into another year, right? So that's important to think about. Like if you're sitting here trying to think about ways to deduct the tax bill this year and you know maybe you're going to sell your company next year and that's going to be a huge tax, you wouldn't want to push more income into next year. You're going to have a big taxable event. You know, maybe you're going to sell an investment property or your partner's going to get a big bonus at work or raise next year. You wouldn't want to push money into that year. Take it this year, right? But the opposite might be true. You might know, hey, maybe I'm a BCBA. I've started out, I was working my W-2 job, but just last month I quit and now I'm on my own, right? So I'm only going to have my business income now. I'm not going to have that extra W-2. I'm probably paying less taxes next year, right? Unless the business does great right off the bat and then you're more, but you if it's doing kind of like what it did this year, you might be in a situation where you're paying less taxes next year. So you might actually benefit from pushing stuff to next year if you're going to be in less of a tax bracket, if you know that there's going to be there was more tax this year than last year. So one thing you could do that doesn't involve like spending money but still impacts cash flow is that you could delay billing at the end of December, right? Don't push submit on those claims the last 2 weeks of December till the last week, because then for sure you're not getting it till January.
Okay.
Right? So that's something you could do if you feel like, oh, I'm already at the top bracket. I think next year I'm probably going to make less because, you know, I didn't sell my house. I sold my house this year. I'm not selling it next year. I don't have a profit. Let me delay the billing just to get it into next year versus this year.
Okay. What about, like, is it too late to set up like a 401k or something like that to try and put something in there to reduce your taxes, or is it too late?
Yeah. There's a lot of compliance with that. If you're not, like, if you just want, like, you're the owner and you can't afford yet to have a retirement plan for the employees, you can go open an IRA, which is an individual retirement account, right? Which is like a 401k. It's a 401k is at work, right? So an IRA is like people that don't have one at their job and go get one. And you can deposit money into that. And you don't have to do that by year end because they let you do it up until the tax deadline. So even like if it's April 14th, I could go and deposit and say it's for 2025.
For ABA companies, the cash flow is, in my opinion, and I believe that from what Joanna has shared with me, that it really is a bigger issue in ABA companies than like your traditional company because of the way the insurance reimbursement works, right?
Yeah, so it's probably no surprise to anyone listening, except maybe if you're just starting out and didn't really, you know, you were just working, you weren't really involved in the operational side of the practice you were at, that the money's not coming quick, right? There are several obstacles between point A and point B, which could delay that money. So in the ABA industry, like the medical industry as a whole, it's very important to think about cash flow and plan for it, right? Versus if I just had a shop where they come in and they pay me right away with their Apple Pay, you know, for the Apple I'm selling, right? I'm getting that money right away. So in this industry, cash flow is a bigger issue and it does need to be proactively managed and owners need to be aware of that. So just the normal delay of a billing, right? Like of getting payment, right? Maybe like the best payers I've seen could pay in 2 weeks, but really I'd say most are around 3-4, right? And some even up to 6 weeks, right? Yes. That's just normal. Nothing's wrong, right? No problem. Yes. But then there can be a problem, right? The authorization number was wrong, put the wrong rendering provider, units were wrong, right? Whatever the case might be, right? Or we send the claim to the wrong place, was new client, right? We didn't know what the payer ID was. If any of those come, then we're adding, right? We're adding to already this pretty lengthy turnaround to get money. Meanwhile, we've got payroll. And nobody's going to be waiting, you know, for us to get paid, or they're not coming to work on Monday. So we need to make sure that we have money for payroll and all the other expenses, right? While we might have delays, right? And that's like for the starters, right? For the growers and closers, right? You need to think about these additional expenses. Like if you're in the growing phase, you might be paying a lot of recruiting. You might have a lot of training time. And while that training is going on, you're not making any money. You need to have extra cash to cover that, right? If you're in the closing phase and you're trying to, you know, you're spending more money on processes and systems to get your practice up to par to get the best valuation, right? That's extra money that's not producing money. So that's why it's really important to be on top of cash flow at these AB practices.
Yeah, and I would say that this is a major challenge because there's so much that's out of our control.
Right. And I mean, especially with like January 1 hits and the vast majority of insurance plans are now switching over. So we have to deal with, you know, maybe for the last 5 months, we haven't had to deal with copays or anything like that. And now we're hit with massive deductibles or, you know, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 deductibles. Copays are back. This could be tough.
Yeah, that's important. That's why I always recommend to the practices, like in December, reach out to all the families.
Yeah.
If they're changing providers for healthcare, they probably already know. Yeah. And so reach out and say, if you anticipate any changes in your health insurance coverage, please let us know as soon as possible, right? And then get information. Are you changing companies? Is it just a different plan at the same company? Did your employer change who they're using, you know, to be ready for that, right? And then as soon as January hits, you want to be re-verifying everyone's benefits. And you want to keep a log of, you know, and new deductible. The deductible is the biggest problem, right? Yep. Because it means you're getting nothing,
right?
If there's a copay, you're still getting something. There's a deductible, you're getting nothing, right? So that's the biggest problem. So you want to make sure that you know if there's a deductible, right? And we'll talk later about collecting that money up front. But just make sure that you're aware of whose policies are changing. Re-verify first week of January. Start calling them. Sometimes they won't have benefits loaded, which is kind of annoying when you call them. But then just keep trying, right? Sooner than later, you want to know, re-verify the benefits. Make sure that they still have the same coverage. And if there's any changes, you want to advise the families of those changes, right? Hey, your copay changed. Hey, now you have a co-insurance instead. It works this way. But that's really important. It's also best practice to be re-verifying benefits at least every quarter at your practice. Like have the admin person do that, because at any point in time, they could lose their job or change policies. And you might not know for months until you notice a huge receivable balance for somebody, right? So it is best practice to be re-verifying benefits at your practice throughout the year.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and so that's just the insurance piece coming in, but then you have payroll. And if you are in that growing space, like we mentioned before, then, like you said, with like training new staff and when you're, I mean, you get yourself into a bond quickly.
Yes.
As you're hiring, even if you're just hiring a couple of staff at the same time, but you're still in that growing.
Yeah.
Period.
I mean, if let's say you hire a BCBA, now we're having to hire 5 techs, 6 techs, right? And so it's not just that 100K or 90K or whatever that BCBA is going to cost. It's also the 5, 6, 7 techs that you're also.
And if you need registered behavior technicians and they are brand new to the field, or they're behavior techs, maybe they have some experience. Yeah. They need their RBT training and certification and sitting for the test and all of that. There are a lot of factors.
Also
involved.
Have to consider credentialing too, because that may delay what payers will allow you to use this BCBA to submit claims. So there's a lot of moving parts, and knowing this up front and planning for it. Yeah. Like just, I wish we would have done more of it. Like that's something that there was so many stressful times, and it was all because of this. We just didn't plan well enough.
We thought that you couldn't. We had this like twisted mentality, I think, that number one, we thought, oh, we'll do it as we go, because we felt like you couldn't plan for this, because we felt like, oh, there's so many unknowns and there's so many changing things and there's so many things out of our control. We're just going to do the best we can.
I think the first few years, we didn't even know what to plan for.
Right.
And then once we kind of got a handle on this, then it was like, oh yeah, we should have probably paid these taxes up front so that we didn't have those fees in April. Right. And so it was always just this, okay, we're growing too quickly. We can't keep up with all of these things. Right. And so having those plans in place, right? Like I wish that 10 years ago when we had our company, you know, we were in the thick of it. We had margin keepers to like guide us through this, right? Having a mentor that could have said, hey, you're going to see these things are going to happen. So we might as well take care of them now.
So, Joanna, what is the plan? What do you need to have in place?
So number one, you want to have good cash reserves, right? And so when we're thinking about cash reserves, we're thinking about 3 to 6 months worth of expenses. And the 3 to 6 month range, right, is probably, you know, you err more on 6 month if you're, let's say you're heavy, you have a heavy government payer, like you're all Medicaid or all TRICARE, right? Those type of funders can have problems more often than not. We've all seen the pause in payments. The recent one when the government shutdown went on, we all had to stress with that, right? So if you are heavy, then you know I need to have more cash because at any point, they could stop paying me for 2 months and what am I going to do? I need to keep going, right? So that's a high risk area where I'd err more on 6 months, right? If you're in a natural disaster zone, so we're thinking, you know, Florida with the hurricanes, California with the fires, you know, you might want to have more reserves because you could possibly be impacted by those more often than people not. Some people, you know, they might not like to have that much in savings in the account, right? Because it's like, well, it's just money sitting there. Well, you can have a brokerage account and have the money. You know, those don't take that long to cash out, right? You're not going to get it the next day. But if you feel like you'll have I've got enough in cash to deal with, you know, a couple weeks, then yeah, put some in a business brokerage account so it could be making some money for you.
Right.
You know, you don't feel like it's a waste. Additionally, like you can also get a credit line, right? Whereas like, you know, I've got that credit line there, right? So this is like a type of loan where you don't actually pay interest unless you're taking the money and you don't take the money unless you need it. These are only good for short-term projects. So like a payment delay, right? Not like I'm opening a clinic, I'm getting a line of credit. That's not what we want to do, right? But they are good. Like if you don't want, you know, maybe you don't have as much or you're working on building your reserve, get a line of credit. Cause then, you know, okay, if I could pull 100 grand from there, worst case scenario, right? I have a way to get that money. The money's relatively quickly in your accounts. So that's also could help with your reserve. Then, you know, try to do some type of cash flow forecasting, right? It could be as simple as, I know these are the expenses I have every month, right? These are the software fees, my professional fees, et cetera, right? The rent, right? Have an understanding. These are the fees that every month happen, you know, and then try to have an understanding of what your payers look like as far as delays, right? You just need to track data maybe for a month, like just see, okay, these dates of service for Aetna are getting paid on these dates and these for Cigna are getting paid on these dates. And you can establish some type of like understanding of, hey, okay, generally it's taking 3 weeks for Cigna to pay and Aetna's taking 4 weeks, right? Because that will help you then if you're in a situation where you're running low on money, anticipating, well, what kind of deposits might I be getting next week, right? So having that type of understanding will help you, right? So not just looking at the bank balance, but understanding these are the monthly recurring stuff, right? That's always going to happen. So I need this much. And this is how slow or how fast these payers are taking to pay. Another thing that's going to help with cash flow discipline is, you know, the collecting cash up front that we'll talk about later. That is going to help with the cash flow policy, right? The other thing is watching AR, right? So a lot of practice owners aren't looking at AR. They have a biller and they know they're billing and if money's coming in, they think it's fine, right?
Yep.
But if you start to feel like, hey, money's tight, hey, I'm having to pull from savings quite often, right? You want, even if that's not happening, is you need to be looking at AR reports if you own a practice. Okay. You don't need to be an expert, but you need to have at a minimum have some high level of looking at it and knowing when you should ask a question, right? And so the report that I recommend that owners look at is called an AR aging. And so an AR aging will show you like the total amount that's receivable. So let's say it's $50,000 and it's going to put it in little buckets. This $10,000 has been outstanding for 30 days. This one for 60, this one for 90, this one for 120, right? what this will help you do is determine, well, what's your risk factor? If we've got things at 120, there's probably a problem, no matter who your payer is, right?
Yep.
So you want to make sure you're asking the biller about those, right? Now, if you can get the AR aging by client, that's best, because then you can see which clients are being problematic. You might notice, hey, the Cigna clients are really racking up amounts. Let me ask the biller what's going on with Cigna claims, right? You might notice that one kid has money in every bucket, right? And what that indicates is a snowball, right? You've got a snowball. No claims are getting paid, and they're moving from one bucket to the next, and they're just going to keep getting older, right? And that's important to address right away. So you might specifically ask about that kid to the biller. Hey, what is going on with JP's claims? I'm seeing them stacking up, right? Because you need to know, you might need to pause services. You might need to get a parent involved. You might need to take additional steps on your end to collect that money. And you want to make sure that you're kind of understanding and it makes sense what the biller's saying, right? Because if the biller's saying, you know, oh, it's just, they're just taking long to process, right? JP's got all this money and they're just taking long to process. Well, let's pretend JP has Aetna. Let's look at a couple other Aetna kids. And we might respond to the biller, well, the other Aetna kids aren't having these type of balances, so why are their claims getting processed and not JP's, right? Because they might need some more. It might be sometimes they assume what the issue is or think what it is, but it might not actually be it. It might be a larger thing, you know, like maybe there was the authorization wasn't on file. Yeah, it didn't go through. We need to stop, you know. So things like that. So that's important. Understanding your biller's report. So just that AR aging, try to get it right. If you have an accountant, they know what an AR aging is. So call up your accountant and be like, hey, can we meet for 30 minutes? I got this report from my biller and I just want you to help me make sense of it. I do that all the time with my clients. I share the screen and I explain to them what it means and what they should ask their biller. And after you do that a couple of times, you'll be able to do it on your own.
Yeah. So I just have a quick question. A lot of times I recommend or urge, business leaders to go ahead and set aside time in their own schedule to like bookmark to take care of these things that can easily be overlooked. How much time would you recommend setting aside each month, to look at tax planning,
AR reports, you know, just like so that you don't fall into that trap of, it's December 26th, well, so like, and I have no idea if I made any money.
Well, I think with the aging reports, right, like it would be like even like putting a event in your calendar, like what, once a month, at like definitely more, right, really, but like minimum once a month to like just check the like
the aging
AR, or you know, because also too, there's the what's it called, Stephen, with if you only have a certain amount of time,
timely payment
yes, to go back,
yeah, and
yes,
recoup,
like, yes, and then some funders, again, if you didn't get the authorization in place, you assumed you got the authorization but it didn't go through for whatever reason, and now you're billing and they don't backdate it, right? Or they got a new primary plan and they didn't tell you about it. And so.
So, I mean, I guess I'm kind of answering my own question. Like, I feel like even like weekly setting aside time weekly to at least put your eyes on these reports and be able to like scan the numbers and shoot some emails out to ask questions, right? Like,
I mean, you really have
to stay on top of this.
Yeah. I think ideally you'd want to have somebody doing the billing that was going to do the majority of this. So you would just spend some time setting up a policy. Like, you want your biller to follow up on a rejected claim within 48 hours, right? So you want your biller to check the status of a claim for a new client 1 week subsequent to it being submitted to make sure it's in progress or moving, right? So if you just set some time aside to set some policies and make sure the right people are in place, that can help alleviate you. Because we all know, right? Like, April, you know, when you're a BCBA and you're running your practice, you're in the fit of it, right? Yes. You don't want to add a bunch of stuff that's just going to be unmanageable. So I think like if you just take time to sit down, set the policy, and then make sure that you have your biller abide by it, whether it be in-house or out-house, right? Then you could be more comfortable that at least that's going on. And then once a month, ask for that AR aging. And when you get, just let your biller know, hey, I want an AR aging once a month. Please send it to me the first week of the month, whatever, last week, third week. And then when you get that email, set, you know, take 30 minutes, look at the report, reply with some questions if you think that there need to be. And that would probably be pretty good practice to cover, okay. You know, identifying like some indicators of possible cash trouble. Like, because most of the companies are keeping their financials on a cash basis, which doesn't really help identify whether there's a problem with collections. You know, with my accrual basis clients, I am able to identify, and I do send notes when I issue those financials. So if I could see that AR balance rising steadily and I don't see the cash coming in, I'll put a note in, hey, check in with the biller. AR is increasing a lot. I'm not seeing cash collections from these payers, right? But if you don't have that, but you're noticing, you know, that payroll's rising faster than the money coming in, that might be an indicator. So if your cash basis just have a bank account trying to figure it out, that might be an indicator there's a problem you might want to look in. You know, if you see an increase in claim denials, it might mean that we're doing something wrong, right? They're just might not being submitted right. And so those are some indicators, and looking at the buckets and seeing, you know, increasing amounts in those older buckets would be another indicator that we discuss.
Yeah.
Just something else for anyone listening, and if they're not overwhelmed yet. also looking at cancellation rate, like that, that's going to be more of a leader indicating, right? So if you're at 25% cancellation rate and you're still paying your staff because maybe some of them are salaried or you have to pay based on the rules in your state for predictive scheduling laws, that can also be a huge factor. Right. So
yeah,
something to,
yeah, I think out of everything, because even me in my limited understanding and knowledge of how all of the financial pieces and insurance and all that were into play, I think that was the number one thing that I did know, right? That was the biggest red flag, was if payroll is rising faster than revenue.
Yeah.
That was like, it was like an immediate, like, oh, okay, I've got to stop everything and figure this out. Now, ideally, what, as Joanna's sharing with you guys, plan ahead of time so you're not surprised by that.
Correct.
But that is definitely, if nothing else, you know, that you need to key into that as soon as possible, because that could, that's when things really start to fall apart, right? Because you have to pay your staff, whether you're getting those payments out or not. So,
and for our closers, you know, if you're looking to sell your company, this is one of the biggest things you're going to look at: your AR, the aging, what collections look like, and it's really going to impact what they think about your practice and the value they're willing to pay.
Right. Oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right. Well, tell us how it works, how taking payment up front could, what that looks like, and how it could be helpful.
Okay. Yeah. So I'd like to start by everyone thinking about when they go to the doctor, right? Mm-hmm. So when we go to the doctor and they check us in the little window, what do they ask us for?
Your copay.
Yeah, our copay, right? Right there, they charge it and take it, right? And so I like to bring that up because they have been doing this way longer than ABA practices have been servicing clients, right? Mm-hmm. So when we think about the grand majority of the healthcare industry, if anybody's ever had a baby, you know, they want your entire deductible collected by week 20, right? Mm-hmm. All these practices in the healthcare industry, they are collecting payment up front, right? And we should be no different. One of the reasons for the copay is to help the practices, because they get, it's mostly to share responsibility, right? Mm-hmm. The insurance companies, if they paid 100% of everything, then you would go to the doctor every time you had a runny nose, right? But if I have to dish out a $40 copay, I'm not going to go every time I have a runny nose, right? So that kind of transfers responsibility. I'm not going to abuse it because I still have to pay something, right? But it's also to help the providers, because they need to wait 3 to 6 weeks for their money, and they need to turn on the lights tomorrow, right? So we should be collecting this payments up front, right? The patient responsibility should be collected up front, right? And so how do we go about implementing this if we're not already implementing this, right? Well, it's going to start off by, you know, the eligibility and benefits check, right? So I like to tell my clients they want to have a master client fee list, I call it, right? You've got like all the clients and what payer they have and whether they have a copay or deductible or co-insurance in different columns, right? They can note there when the max is met if they find that out, right, et cetera, right? So you want to make sure you understand the client's benefits, right? Because you're going to need to communicate communicate with them that these are the benefits and this is the part you're responsible for and how I'm going to collect it, right? So once you have an understanding, and so let's pretend we get a new client and they have Blue Cross Blue Shield. We call up Blue Cross Blue Shield and they let us know patient is approved for services, right? There is a $25 copay each session, right? It's important to note sometimes the copay can change depending where the session is, right? Do you ever see that, Stephen, when you guys had your practice, it might have applied to the clinic, but not at home, you know? So
I didn't know that. Did we have that?
So the biggest thing was they typically, most funders wouldn't collect two copays in a day. So if you were like, you had parent training on the same day,
yeah,
quick service.
It's once a day. Yeah, I've never seen it not be once a day, right? So even if it's at different times during the day, it's once a day. Once you have noted, right, that client has that copay, you're going to communicate it to the parent, right? And then because we're not a doctor's office, like some of us might have clinics and we couldn't have a POS machine at reception and we could be charging as they come in. That's very possible, right? But we know that a lot of what we do is community-based, home-based, right? And we're not going to be giving merchant portals to every RBT to carry around and be responsible for, right? Yeah. So the best practice is going to be just to get them to fill out like either an ACH debit authorization or a credit card debit authorization for ongoing. So you get them to sign this, you know, authorizing for the auto charging to their account on a weekly basis. And every week, you know, on Mondays, you could do last week and say, okay, so-and-so came four times. He has a copay of 20, four times 20, $80. I'm sending the invoice, right? But I'm auto charging, right? That's best. Like some people won't want to do that. And then like, okay, that's fine. You could still send an invoice, but then what does that cost? More headache for you. You need a follow up. Did they pay it? Send a reminder, call a mom and say, hey, you haven't paid it, right? It's better to just do the auto charge because then you can do it, right? So you send them the invoice. So I tell my clients, you know, send the invoice and then give it a day or 2 days. And then if you haven't heard back, contemplating, you know, somebody saying, hey, that's not right, then have the charge, right? So if you're going to send these out on Monday, you could tell your admin on Wednesday to actually charge those through, right? Okay. So you get the auto permission, you establish the benefits, right? And then you charge in that manner, right? So copay is the easiest, right? Because it's just once per day, it's a flat amount, it's really easy, right? A little trickier when we have a client with a deductible or a co-insurance, right? So the deductible, it's important to talk to them at the beginning of the year. And for any of our growers listening that aren't currently doing this, this is a perfect time because you can have a policy change effective next year. You just let everyone know, all your clients know, we got a new policy this year, right? And you start to gather this stuff. But so if they have a deductible, they have to pay for the whole claim. So you have to know what the whole claim is for, which you'll know, right, when the biller's doing the claim, right, for the contracted rates. Most of us in our practice management systems were able to load in our contracted rate along with a billing rate, which is an inflated rate, right? So you'll be able to know the amount, right? So you'll have to send the invoice for the whole amount. Usually when it's deductible, you might want to like, wait a little bit more to ask them, like, because the bills will be quite high. So we're talking probably over $1,000 for 1 week, on average for a client who's seen, you know, 20 to more hours. So you might want to check with the parents. And so those are going to be larger ones. Hey, is it okay if I hit it through? The parent might say, hey, I can't do it all at once. That's fine. You could say, okay, well, how about we do 500 this week, 500 next week? You work with them, right? To come up with something that works for everybody to collect that. The co-insurance too is a bit more difficult than a copay because it's a percentage. So you need to know what the whole claim was for. And then so if it's $2,000 claim at the contracted rates and it's 10%, you know, you need to collect 200 from them. Right. So again, with your softwares, you should be able, if you have your contracted rates loaded, to be able to see. Or you might want to decide that you're just going to do it with copays because this is too much for you. You're not going to, you know, maybe you don't have a biller yet or anybody to help with that, or an admin person. So you're doing everything on your own. So at least do copays and not those. But I would recommend doing everything, right? The deductible, the co-insurance, and the copay. Gets a little tricky because basically if there's a deductible, there's generally a co-insurance attached to that. So the way it works is that there's a $2,000 deductible, right? And once that's completely paid, then the co-insurance kicks in. So there can be a claim where it's in the cutoff, right? Mm-hmm. And so you've got like $500 left of the deductible. So you need to charge that $500, but there's the, you know, $600 more on the claim. Well, that gets hit with the 20%. Right, or the 10% or whatever it is. So that gets a little tricky at that point. But then going forward, it's just that flat percentage. So every week you would have your set date where your admin person would, you know, because in a perfect world, an admin person would be doing this, not you, the BCBA running the practice. Right. It's too much, right? So that you would look at the at what the bill is and send out that invoice. If you don't hear back in 2 days, you're going to auto charge the account, right? And so getting a merchant processor is pretty straightforward. Most of the practices probably already have them, even if they're not collecting up front, because they have to collect at a certain point. Yeah. But if not, you know, even if you just have a QuickBooks subscription, you can add it on there. Most of the banks will add it onto your account.
Here's a pushback I'm going to give to you on this, because I personally did not like collecting up front for one of the reasons that you said, right? Like, because the insurance would never update their deductible very well. So you could call them up and say, okay, I'm pretty sure they're close to hitting their deductible based on my own calculation, right? Like, our ABA is going to be the vast majority of their copays and or their costs. Maybe they have speech every once in a while, or they go see a doctor, but I'm going to be paying the vast majority. I'm going to be collecting the vast majority of that deductible. But the funder says, no, they still haven't done it yet. They still owe $1,000. And you're like, I know that they owe more than that, or they owe less than that, because I've already collected $1,500, right? And so what happens is that unless you're really paying attention very well, you've collected too much. And now, you know, your merchant account has taken 3-4%. And now you're having to reimburse them the full amount. And so now you've lost 4% of a certain amount of money. So I would just wait until the end. And the same on the other end is when they reach their out-of-pocket max for the year, right? Unless I am actively keeping up with that. And then again, even at some point, I'm going to have to stop collecting copays, co-insurance. That may be 4 months in, that may be 3 months in. It just depends on how much benefit they have, how good their plan is. But the insurance company is like, no, they still owe more for their out-of-pocket max. And then they come back retroactively and say, actually, we shouldn't have been charging them copays. We should be paying you the full amount. And so then again, you're going back and you're having to reimburse the families the money that you collected. And you're actually losing because you can't get that 3.5% or that 4% back that you lost. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it's a legitimate concern, right? Because it's going to happen. It's going to happen. As far as like losing the 4%, I would just, rather than offering the reimbursement, that might happen with a deductible, right? And now we need to reimburse, but they still have a co-insurance. So I just offer, okay, I'm going to carry it to apply to your co-insurance going forward. So I would do that first to avoid losing the 4%. Out-of-pocket maxes are generally met late in the year, and the policy is going to reset. Hey, you want me to hold it? You're getting a deductible in January. I'll use it for that. So you could do that if your main concern is losing that 4%, right? As far as the other factors, right, like there needs to be a way of knowing what actually happens, right? We are charging based on what we believe, just like your doctor's asking you for that copay based on the fact that you have a copay. He's not calling to check if you met the max or if it's not going to apply because you went to a more expensive doctor yesterday, right? He's going to know when he gets the EOB. Right? And you're going to get an EOB as the patient, then you'll know, hey, I shouldn't have been charged it. Next time I go, I'm going to ask him for that money, right? So there needs to be a way for it where the providers are tracking this, right? Which is not only for this, but because you can be overpaid by an insurance company, right? A claim can get paid twice, and you're responsible for notifying the company and sending the money back, right? If they haven't come back to reproach it yet. Right. So in your billing system, there must be a way to track this. Right. And generally how it is where the payments are applied. Right. So your biller should be able to tell you if you already collected the copay, because generally if you're collecting, you're letting your biller know. Right. If it's an outside biller, if the inside biller is keeping track of it. But if it's an outside vendor, you don't know, hey, I collect these copays and this from these people. And in their system, they're putting they got it, right? So when they get that money from the insurance company, if it is more than what it was open for, they then have to notify you, hey, this was an overpayment. And then you'll know, hey, that's due back to the client. In fact, they had met their max, so the copay shouldn't have been that day, right? Right. It's going to be impossible for you to know, not only because they go to other doctors, but a lot of deductibles are family deductibles. You have no idea what's going on with the brother and the sister and the mother, right? So you just, you know, quote on what you know. And then, but it is very important are the section for compliance on this subject, right? That's one of the main notes here, is that you need to be able to track what's happening, which is what should be happening for a practice to be operating financially healthy, right? You need to be tracking or know who do you owe money to or whatnot. So if you have those systems in place, you should be able to identify when it happens and then go to the client and let them know. And then again, I would start off by offering a credit to apply to future invoices, since if they're staying with you, they're more likely than not will be, before offering that refund to avoid your 4% thing.
Yeah, no, that's a smart idea. I just never even thought, when I was going through that, I never even thought, hey, you're going to owe me this anyway, so you might as well just...
Especially if it's like a $35, $40 copay, most parents are going to be like, yeah, just hold on to that, knowing that they're going to... Sure. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
So the other thing too, though, is quite a few times that it would happen that a family would stay with us, they would like have a large deductible and we would not collect that right up front. And, and then they would leave and they would ghost us. They would go on to a different provider. And then there were several situations where we never were able to get that money, right? And we even like chased it through collections and spent money, right? And that was something we learned in the early years of, wow, this is a thing that people do sometimes.
Yeah, right? It's very common. Yeah. And and like you say, you're going to pay a collection company to deal with $1,000. Mm-hmm. You might not want to. They're not even going to recover the whole $1,000, you know? So then you're losing.
Exactly. And I do think it's important to have those conversations, even if they're ongoing clients and, you know, you've checked in with them in like November, December, are there any changes in your insurance for next year? And they're like, no. And then you can say, okay, great. Well, let's, you know, remember, you know, you have like, you, of course you would choose your words wisely, but basically say, hey, remember, you've got this huge deductible. Mm-hmm. So going into the new year, would you like to set up a payment plan would you like to, you know, how would you like this? Cause also too, like most families that like second week of January aren't going to be able to like cough up $1,000 after the holidays, especially, right? And now of course, if it's, it might not be a conversation that you have until mid January, if someone's changed to a new plan and they're just learning their plan and you're learning their plan. But still, I think it's a legal thing, right? That you're supposed to disclose that, just to have these conversations.
Oh yeah, so the no surprises, but that's more for like at a network.
Okay, but still, even I think, and even just ethically, bound by our board, right? Like we should have these conversations
and information of what their expenses are,
and not assume that parents understand what these things mean. Like they may not even understand what it means. They're like, oh, well, I should just probably have a copay, but they might not understand what deductible or coinsurance and all of this. And then also may not have taken into consideration that, hey, if I have 5 sessions a week, you know, at 4 sessions or 5 2-hour sessions a week, like, this adds up.
Yes, it adds up very quickly.
It is very expensive.
And have you seen any ABA companies successfully use like care credit or anything like that for deductibles?
I haven't heard any of my clients using that.
Okay.
But it's probably worth looking into. And what's also important on this topic for like our starters that they might not understand is that these copays and these coinsurances, they're not extra money. They're a reduction from the claim total, which means that if you believe you need to, and in most ABA practices, this is fact, you need the whole contractual rate to make even, to break even, and to get a little bit of profit, right? You need that whole rate. So if you're saying that you're giving away part of it, never going to get it, you can be in trouble quite quickly. So it's not extra money. They're going to reduce it from what they pay you. So you need to collect all of it to actually be getting your $50 rate per hour or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, that's really important to emphasize. Yeah.
And then based on your contract, you are required to make an attempt to collect copays and co-pays.
Yes.
Yeah, we hear sometimes of companies who
just waving
copays. Yeah, and that's a very good point, because literally the payer could come tell you, "Oh, great, you don't need this money. I'm slashing your rates." Yeah. If you are not collecting it, you're still going to get the copay. Yeah. So you definitely don't just want to be waving copays without a systematic system, checking with a lawyer about what's legal in your state and what there's a lot of consistency that probably needs to be met there with you applying that without no discrimination, essentially, right?
Yep. Exactly.
So it's not something you just want to be doing without consulting an attorney in your state.
No, and I hear it often. Well, I know the company down the street is doing it, so I'm going to do it too, right? And that's just like, if you catch yourself, audience, if you're catching yourself saying that, not a good practice, right?
Your cue to get curious and check into it yourself, right? Yep. Reach out to a professional.
Just the last thing is just to make sure with compliance, right? You do still want to check with your payers. There's a possibility a payer might not allow this. I haven't seen it, but you always want to check, right? Check with your payers to make sure there's no requirements. And that's true on all fronts, right? You always want to check your contracts if there be things not related to money, maybe related to RBT credentials that are necessary or something like that. And you might not know. You want to read these contracts carefully. You want to understand your obligations under them and make sure you're not violating them when you implement any policy at your practice.
Wow. This has been so helpful. Again, I know Stephen already said it once, but I'm going to say it again. Like, where were you? Where were you like 10 years, 15 years ago? We were starting I'm so thankful for you guys at Margin Keepers. I'm so thankful for the expertise that you provide the field. I'm so thankful for, I know we have a sponsorship partnership here, but even still, the fact that you're willing to come on and share this information just for like the greater good of the field and how much knowledge that you have, it's just amazing. And so very thankful. Thank you for coming on today.
Yeah. Oh, no, of course. And I just wanted, one point before when Stephen asked me about the tips and I said it was not till next year. I just checked and it did go into effect retroactively, but the IRS did release a list of jobs. So it can't be every job.
Okay. But I'm assuming ABA is not on that.
Not specifically.
I'm going to give myself a $100,000 tip this year.
Wouldn't that be something?
Wouldn't it?
Yeah. No. They wouldn't last long. They would figure out really quick, what did we do? Yeah. All right. Well, is there anything else that we didn't get to today that you want to make sure to cover?
No, that was it. It was great catching up with you guys. And I hope these topics help a lot of the practices that are listening run more efficient and financially savvy practices.
Yeah. And if you're worried about any of this stuff, again, I urge you to sign up for the free consult. It's so helpful. And just get some support. And yeah, that's it.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. I know you're busy. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule and tuning in today. And we hope that you have a great rest of your day. Thanks for joining us on ABA Business Leaders.
We provide mentorship, courses, handbooks, billing support, credentialing, HIPAA support, web design, and more. Everything you need to build an ethical and sustainable ABA practice.
You can find all of our resources at 3pisquared.com.
Don't forget to subscribe and share this podcast with other ABA business owners.
We'll see you next time. And remember, you don't have to build your practice alone.